Acts 15 is where we need to be. Acts chapter 15, this is in the context of a problem. As we've said a couple times, this has taken a little while to get through as far as this chapter. Paul and Barnabas, they return from the first missionary journey. They come back to the congregation at Antioch, and while they're there, there are some people who are, I'm going to call them false teachers, but they come claiming that the Gentiles need to obey things related to Moses' law, and they're not willing to accept Paul as an apostle and his judgment on the matter. So everybody goes down to Jerusalem to talk about it with the other apostles, not to establish doctrine, but to show that this really is the truth. Let's pick up, let's just go back to about verse 6. And the apostles and the elders were gathered together to consider this matter. So everybody has finally come together. Verse 7, and Peter, after there had been a lot of discussion, Peter rose up and had several things to say. He says then in verse 11 of Acts 15, but we believe that we shall be saved through the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ in like manner as they. After Peter speaks, everybody's silent. Verse 12, and they hearkened unto Barnabas and Paul. Barnabas and Paul stand up, and they begin to talk about the signs and the wonders that God had wrought among who? Among the Gentiles. Now, if you remember, in our last class, we pulled out a reference from 1 Corinthians. It said, the Jews sought or craved what thing? Anybody remember? The Jews craved signs or miracles. Remember that reference? All right, so Paul and Barnabas said, what you wanted, the Jews, the miracles, the signs and so forth, what you so earnestly desired, guess who God gave those to? The Gentiles. Well, if he gave them what you really want, that's strongly suggestive of equality. So that's sort of how Paul and Barnabas argue their case. Peter said, look, this has already happened 10 years ago at the household of Cornelius. We knew that they were equal. Paul and Barnabas jump on the ship, and they say they're equal through the signs and the wonders. And then after that, you have in verse 13, and after they held their peace, James answered them, saying, and this is what he said, brethren, hearken unto me, Simeon, or Peter, hath rehearsed how first God visited the Gentiles to take out for them or of them a name for his name. And to this agree the words of the prophets as it is written. And that's going to bring us to new material, but let's not go quite there yet. All right, this James begins to talk. And the word answered suggests that he is responding to false teachers, some of whom, as you go back to verse 5, were Pharisees. Now, as I said before, and this is a point that you just need to have impressed into your minds, I think, that this was no church council to settle church doctrine. If you, for example, talk to the Jehovah's Witnesses and there would be some other groups, they come to your door and you ask them about the Watchtower organization that they have in New York, they would say, well, the Watchtower, we justify that because of Acts 15. This is sort of our church council. This is our headquarters. These guys didn't come to headquarters. Jerusalem wasn't headquarters for the church. Every congregation is autonomous. Acts chapter 14 and verse 23. The information here was not to take a vote to determine whether or not the Gentiles, remember, Peter said that's already been settled 10 years ago, Acts chapter 10 and verse 35, I believe. But there was a need to take a stand for the truth, so Peter's taking a stand for the truth. Paul and Barnabas took a stand for the truth, as we just read. And now this James stands up, and he's also going to take a stand for the truth about verses 13 through 21. If you're going to have a meeting, for that meeting to go well, what do you need to have in the meeting?
A leader.
All right, you need to have a leader. Some people would say it's a chairman or a chairperson. You need to have somebody who's directing the meeting. If you don't have a leader in the meeting, it's probably not going to go very well. So if you've ever been in a men's meeting in a congregation or you have a meeting at work, somebody has to sort of be the head of that snake. They have to be the boss. All right, James seems to have taken the lead here at this meeting, and we'll give a couple of reasons for that in a bit. But there are some people in the denominational realm who say that James was president of the conference. Well, that's not what's going on here, even though that's what's sometimes claimed. But he does sort of come to the forefront. He picks up on what Peter had said, and then he begins to point us to the Old Testament. He goes back to the prophets, have more to say about that after a bit, but specifically, he brings to mind Amos. Anybody know who this James is? All right, he's the half-brother to the Lord. We know he's not James the Apostle. For what reason? All right, we go back just three chapters in Acts chapter 12, starting with verses 1 and 2. Remember Peter, they wanted to put him on the chopping block. That didn't work out. Peter's life was preserved. But James the Apostle has already died. So you have to say this is not James the Apostle. As you look at the book of Acts, you're going to see this fellow again mentioned. He's going to be mentioned in Acts chapter 21 and verse 18. More importantly for us, though, he's mentioned in the book of Galatians, Galatians 2:9. Now, I've said that Galatians 2 and Acts chapter 15 seem to describe the same event. In Galatians 2:9, this James is described. James and John were, remember, in the church, Jerusalem, they were what? They were pillars in the church. What do you think that expression conveys? You're a pillar in the church. You're a pillar in the community. You're a pillar at work.
You're a leader.
All right, you're a leader. That would be one good description. Anything else?
Respect.
All right, there's going to be respect for you as a leader. Anything else?
Upright.
All right, you're going to think of somebody who's trying to live their life in a correct way. Anything else? A pillar.
Well-known.
That's good, too. What about when somebody speaks, people are going to listen? If you're a pillar in a congregation or a pillar in the community, when you go on TV or when you are out there in front of a crowd, if you are a pillar, people are probably going to pay some attention to you. Well, he has that kind of reputation. He's that kind of leader. So when he does speak, and he seems to be the last speaker here, he is the one that really helps carry the day, so to speak. Now, when you look at this guy, you remember from what Marcia said, he was a half-brother in Jesus' family. Was he an immediate believer in Jesus? No. John 7:5 says, for not even his brethren believed on him. And that would be Jesus' family. It took what event for James to come to a belief in Christ? Same was true for the rest of the family.
Death, burial, resurrection.
All right, Jesus dies. Well, if your brother dies, I mean, that's pretty plain. But when he comes back from the dead, you have to start looking at that and say, okay, I think I need to revise my understanding of who I grew up with. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 7, Paul says that Jesus did appear to this James. If Josephus is correct, and sometimes we think that he is just way out there, other times it seems like Josephus is on target, but if Josephus is correct about this James died in AD 61, and he died by stoning. So if the church was established about AD 33, you know, he's got about 30 years there that he was able to be a Christian, and that was certainly plenty of time to be a good influence for good in the area of Jerusalem. All right, now, here's this guy, James. An apostle or not?
No.
He's not an apostle. And yet, even though he's not an apostle, what picture do you get from him at this meeting? All right, you know, this guy, when it comes to this meeting, I mean, he's going to be one of the big influential leading characters to speak. Now, I find that to be interesting because Paul and Barnabas, they've come from Antioch down to Jerusalem. And let's back up a little bit in the text. Let's go back. Well, we can see it from verse 2. Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension, questioning with them that would have been at Antioch. The brethren appointed Paul and Barnabas and certain other than them that they should go to Jerusalem. Unto who? Go down to the apostles. Now here you've got the apostles at Jerusalem. They're coming together and they're going to make sure that they try to confront the false teachers as a group. And at this meeting, who would you think would be all the speakers? You'd think the apostles would be because, I mean, these are just under Christ as far as authority. But you've got the apostles at Jerusalem. They all have the truth. They have their meeting. And yet, in spite of that, in spite of their great authority, who's the one who really begins to jump to the forefront here and speak?
James.
It's James.
The version I have says apostle and elders. Is it possible James was an elder?
It's possible. Yeah, and maybe that was part of his influence. But why do you have someone with, quote-unquote, lesser authority, he's not an apostle, taking the lead, when you have people with more authority who certainly were more than capable of dealing with the matter? Why do that?
Because he was worshipped with that congregation. Maybe he was had more.
All right.
Maybe.
That could be. And along with that, is there anything that we can take from that as far as a practical lesson today?
His lineage helped him a whole lot. Being a brother of
I think that probably was somewhat influential. At least people probably had a lot of questions. What was it like to have Jesus as a half-brother? What did you see? I'm sure he was probably peppered with questions. At least I could have given him a couple dozen.
And if Paul could have converted, if James could have converted and convinced all the people in Jerusalem,
yes,
the
Yes.
So the status grows among the congregation there.
Yeah. Related to all those things is this additional point. Do you find sometimes in life a person with greater authority yielding to someone who has lesser authority?
Sometimes.
Where do you see it?
Sometimes.
All right. Sometimes in the political realm, you'll see that. Here's a person who maybe it's the president or maybe it's a congressperson. They will defer to another person for a particular reason. I've got a specific example in mind, but that's a good start. Anything else? Where do you see deference?
It oftentimes shows up in businesses, and I was using manufacturing as an example. There may have been supervisors, there may have been two or three layers of supervisors, but they want to know the specifics, and they then defer to the engineer who knows what the answers that they need.
Yeah, maybe it's a problem. And the supervisor, he's not really the hands-on guy. So when he's got to go explain the problem, let's bring somebody in. They have lesser authority. I saw that at the Hummer plant quite a bit. You know, there were people who had obviously lesser authority, but they were the authority on that particular problem. So here you have a fellow on the line, or here you have a fellow who's specially trained, and GM, they were the ones with the big stick, but they would say, okay, we're going to listen to you because you have the knowledge and so forth. And sometimes, because of what a person knows, or maybe because of a person's reputation, or as Betty was saying, sometimes in the political realm, you will defer to that person, and that's exactly what we have here.
I'm not sure, though, that the person with the higher authority would defer to the lower authority if a decision was to be made.
Correct.
That affects everybody. Then he makes the decision. So this is what you're having here.
Well, remember, though, the decision has already been made. God made the decision about accepting the Gentiles with nothing. So in that case, you would be correct. But in this case, and you could actually make that point, Dom, to show what's taking place here, that you're not yielding to a lesser to determine what's right. That's already been determined. But in this case, you're yielding to someone with lesser authority to explain what's right. It is.
Well, a lot of times, like in the military, for example, and in particular the Army, officers, they not only trust in the judgment of, but call on the judgment of the sergeant major.
Sure.
I mean, in a lot of instances, the sergeant major runs the show, and the officer just sits in the back there by his desk and he takes advice from the sergeant major, because this guy's been in there for 30 years and he's got all the experience. And this officer may be right out of candidate school, or he might have come from another base somewhere, doesn't have anything to do with this problem. He's fresh on the job, and so while the officer has the final say-so, he's going to base that final say-so on a lot of what that sergeant tells him.
That's absolutely correct. That was one of the little lessons I tried to impart to our son-in-law, who's currently a captain. I said, listen to your NCOs, your non-commissioned officers. They will keep you out of a lot of trouble. They will help you if you're willing to listen to them. And I think he already got that in officer training school. But I said, whether or not they taught you that or not, you need to do that, because they've been, as you said, a lot more years than you have, and they're kind of the people on the ground, so to speak, and if you have a good working relationship with them, it's going to make your life a lot easier and probably keep you out of some troubles. But even in some factories, you know, you can go in and you can be the plant manager, or you can be this or that, but chances are there are going to be some people in that factory that know some things that you don't, because they've spent time out in the line and so forth.
When I worked at Wayne Assembly up there, Ford plant, the plant manager was a colonel in the Marine Corps, and he ran that plant just like he ran those Marines. And it was funny, because he wasn't hard on the hourly people at all. I worked a double shift one time, and I fell asleep upside down on the front seat under the dashboard, because it was my second time around, you know, and I've been working for almost 16 hours straight. And he come by and kicked me on the hind end. He says, go home, you're not doing me any good. But I've heard that same guy get all over those supervisors. And in such a way as you would have thought they were in the military still.
Yeah.
You know, but that's just the way he ran the ship, you know.
And that has happened with more than one.
Yeah.
Thank you. When you look at denominationalism, they have used this information about James to say that only clergy can or should speak at church councils. That's part of the reason why we're plodding so slowly through Acts chapter 15. People have used this in a lot of bad ways and pulled all sorts of bad stuff out of it. But again, it is not a church council, and he's not clergy. He is this fella who's a Christian, developed that good reputation, and wanted to be a leader. Now, James is important for another reason. If you were to read through his book, anybody remember how long the book of James is? How many chapters?
Five.
All right, would you say that's a short book or a long book? All right, I think all of us would classify that as a short book. One of the things that you find in the book of James is the word law. At least 10 times in that book he talks about law. Law, 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 law. Remember the royal law of liberty? That's just one of the references. If any man stumbles in one part of the law, again, it comes up again and again and again. If there's anybody at this meeting in Jerusalem who is going to say the Gentiles need to obey some part of the law, guess who's a likely candidate? It's the guy who has a lot to say about the word law. But this guy who has a lot to say about the word law comes along and really says, look, what Peter told you, this matter has already been settled 10 years ago by God, that's the truth. What Paul and Barnabas said, all that's true. And now I support that teaching as well. All right, now as you look at the people who were listening to James, they might have been stunned. At the end of verse 14, he says what? God did what? God made a visit. Who did he go see?
Gentiles.
The Gentiles. If you were a Jew at this meeting, do you think that might have gotten your attention? He visited the Gentiles. Well, okay, I wonder what he did. What's he say? God not only visited them, he
took people out of them for his name.
Ouch. If you were a Jew, and you can go back to the book of Deuteronomy, there are a couple passages over there which essentially say that that's what God did for the Jews. He said, I took people, I took this nation, I took these Hebrew people. One of the references that you could look at if you want a passage in conjunction with that is going to be Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 10. God said, this is what I did for you. Now he says, I went to the Gentiles, I visited them, and I had with them the same purpose that I had for you. I called them out to give them a name. Now, before we pick up with Acts chapter 15, 15 through 18, hone in on what it just said. God says, I've called you out. Does that bring anything to mind? Called out?
The church.
The church. Or Christians. The word church, ecclesia, means what? It means the called out. And that's what God did for the Jews. One second, Bonnie. We're called out of the world. We're called out of sin. We're called out of darkness. And as we get into the next verse and what follows, he says, the prophets talked about this as well. Bonnie?
What was that reference in Deuteronomy?
It's Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 10. We can go back there and read it quickly if you like.
Oh, that's okay. I was just writing in the 28.
Yeah, I think I've got it. All right, the 10th verse says, and all the peoples of the earth shall see that thou art called by the name of Jehovah, and they shall be afraid of thee. So, that's what happened with Israel several centuries earlier, and God says, look, I also did this to the Gentiles. Anything before we start looking at Acts 15, 15 through 18? Don?
Is it interesting that he took Peter's word for it without questioning it?
Yeah.
Because he said Peter actually declared that.
Yeah.
That's what he said.
Yeah.
Peter.
So, take out is what we have in verse 14. Called out might be in some other versions that you have here. Now, when we look at Acts chapter 15, verses 15 through 18, this is really important material. In fact, it might take more than today's class. Last week, if you're in the class, Don brought up a friend, and he was talking about some things from Revelation and dispensationalism, the people who have some strange ideas about what Jesus is going to do at the end of time. Acts chapter 15, 15 through 18, is one of the key verses if you ever talk to somebody who has that kind of idea. The text says, and to this, that is to all this stuff about the Gentiles being okay with God, they don't have to do the stuff the Jews were obligated to do under the Old Testament, and to this agree the words of the prophets, notice that that's plural, as it's written, and here it goes back to Amos, Amos 9. After these things I will return, and I will build up again the tabernacle of David which has fallen, and I will build up again the ruins thereof, and I will set it up, that the residue of men may seek after the Lord, and all the Gentiles. Notice that all the Gentiles upon whom my name is called, saith the Lord, who maketh these things known of old. This is where James gets into his argument. And he says, I'm going to base part of my argument on the prophets. And James says in the verses that we read, the prophets talked about the acceptance of the Gentiles. Now, if you were to go back to Amos, you could turn back to Amos chapter 9, verses 11 and 12. And in Amos 9, 11 and 12, that's where you have the information that Amos is pulling from. Now, Amos, if you go back and you look at his life and work, his time, in Amos chapter 1 and verse 1, we have some information about when he was working. It was during the time of Uzziah, king of Judah. As you go back and you look at that time in Israel's history, a couple of things are taking place. Number one, David is out of the picture. Number two, Solomon's temple has been built. Now, that's important because if you're going to have a place for the ark, that was going to be Solomon's temple. And at this time in Hebrew history, things were going okay with the temple. It wasn't in a state of ruin. It wasn't in a state of disrepair. Everything was functioning as it should. So Amos writes this information. And he actually kind of backs up in history. He says, there's David. And then, you know, we think about David. He didn't build the temple. He got the stuff ready so Solomon could build the temple. But he talks about David and the tabernacle. And that really seems to be somewhat unusual. And then he said that David's tabernacle was in ruins. Let's pause for a second and define the word tabernacle. What's tabernacle mean? The Israelites had a tabernacle. What was that? Well, a place of worship, that would be true. What else? A tent. That's basically what a tabernacle was. It was a portable structure. So when you think about a tent, you put it up, take it down, you're in there for a little while, and probably put it away until maybe next year, until at least your next camping trip. Now that complicates things, at least on the surface a little bit. If you have this tabernacle, this tent, would you use words like, and back in Amos 9, I think he actually uses the word breach, depending on your version. Would you talk about the tabernacle, the tent being breached? What? When you think about breach, tabernacle or temple would seem more logical. Breaches in the tabernacle or breaches in the temple? Temple. And when you think about what we have here in Acts chapter 15, I will build up, I will repair, I'm going to be the fixer-upper. Who's the I refer to? God. You think God would need to fix up an old tent? That just doesn't really seem to fit very well. So on the surface, it does seem to be a little bit of a complicated passage. But there's some help for us. Amos and James both say that David's somehow involved with this, and God is somehow going to have a special attachment to it. Before we delve any deeper into this, let's go back to the book of Isaiah for a second. Fairly early in the book of Isaiah, chapter 16 and verse 5, that's the passage that we want. Isaiah is touching on this same thing. And even though we might not be able to figure everything out from 16:15, at least that's going to put us on the right road. Anybody there and want to read it for us? Isaiah 16? All right, Betty? 15. Or, I'm sorry, 16:5. I apologize.
And a house shall be established in loving kindness, and one shall set thereon in courage and truth, in the tent of David, judging and seeking justice, and swift to do right.
Okay, now that's interesting. What's going to be established? A throne. Well, if you're establishing a throne, what does that imply? Well, that's true. That wasn't really the answer that I wanted. Huh? Well, that too. Something before that, though. If I say I'm going to make a cake, what does that suggest right now about my cake supply?
You don't have one.
I don't have one. All right. I didn't ask the question very well, but I thought if we fished around long enough, we'd find it. I don't currently have a cake. So if I'm going to establish a throne, what does that suggest? It's not there yet. Something has happened to it, or it has not yet been it's not yet been created. So it says, a throne shall be established, and one shall sit on it. And then he says, it's going to be where? It's going to be in the tent, or it's going to be in the tabernacle of David. Well, that sounds a lot like Amos 9. That sounds a lot like Acts chapter 15. But still, we need to kind of figure some things out here. Now, in the church, and this is certainly not wrong. I don't think it goes far enough, though. In the church, if you were in a lot of Bible classes, you would probably hear a teacher come along and say, well, this is the restoration of David's dynasty, and how was David's dynasty restored? Israel goes into sin, basically the kings, you know, are toast. The nation goes into captivity, and they're never restored to, you know, what they had in the old days. So how's David's promise fulfilled? All right, it's fulfilled through Jesus. In Luke chapter 1, 32 through 33, the Bible says that Jesus was going to come, and he was going to have a kingdom. And Paul, as we take a look, I'm going to read this one from 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 8. Thinking about the Lord, he connects that promise to Christ. He specifically does that. 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 8, Paul says there, remember Jesus Christ, risen from the dead, of the seed of, want to guess who? David. So Jesus is of David's seed. He's raised up for that kingdom. In fact, if we back up just a little bit in the book of Acts, Acts chapter 2 and verse 30, on the day of Pentecost, as Peter is preaching, in that 30th verse, he has this to say. Being therefore a prophet, that was David, and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that of the fruit of his loins he would set one on his throne. So on the day of Pentecost, Peter picks up with the same idea. He says, David knew that somehow there was going to be a king set on his throne. Well, that didn't happen with literal Israel, but it did happen through Christ. And he's got that spiritual throne, and now he reigns spiritually. And in that spiritual kingdom, you can see the connection that James is trying to make. Who is able to come? Who's able to be part of that spiritual kingdom? In the church, who's welcome? Jews and Gentiles, all in one. So a lot of people would say that that's what he's talking about here. I mentioned last time with the question that Don raised, back in Romans chapter 2, 28 and 29, Paul said the person who's the Jew is not who is one outwardly. That is, it's not a matter of circumcision. He said it's a matter of the heart. It's the person who obeys the gospel. And Paul, in the book of Ephesians, chapter 3, verses 3 through 6, said that this is the great mystery. Now, as I said, I think all that's true. And all that is certainly consistent with the promise that Amos made in Amos 9 as far as raising up David's tabernacle. But I think that there's more involved. Before we get to what I think is additional information that is tied in with all this, I want to give you the denominational view. And Don, this is kind of where we go back to you and your friend. This is a quote from one leading denominational writer. He thinks that Amos' prophecy means that God will regather his people Israel to their land and bless them abundantly. And for a lot of people who have various millennial ideas, that's what they think. That there's going to be this time in the future that Israel's going to be restored and that Jesus is going to come down and be a king and Israel's going to be there and it's all going to be glorious. Now, there are a couple things about that that I find odd. The people say that, and then on the other hand, they're thinking, well, you know, Christ is going to come and that's going to end all things. I don't really see how those two things go together. The other thing here, anybody ever hear of the Scofield Reference Bible? Okay, anybody happen to have one? Okay. If you were to look through at least some editions of that, I'll give you this quote as well. It said, dispensationally, that is this end of time stuff that people believe, this is the most important passage in the New Testament. That's why I said when Don raised this question last week, if you're talking to someone who has some end of time beliefs about this weird stuff, more than likely they're going to at some point discuss Acts chapter 15, because this is what they think, that David's tabernacle has to be raised up, and they have the idea that that has not yet been done. Let me show you something, I think, which is absolutely devastating to the people who have that kind of view. Anytime somebody wants to come over to Acts chapter 15, let's go back and look at the text again. Maybe you'll see it. And to this the words of the prophets agree, as it is written, after these things I will return. I'm going to build up the tabernacle of David, which is fallen. I'm going to again build the ruins thereof. I'm going to set it up. I'm going to do this with David's tabernacle, that For, because, why? I'm going to raise up the tabernacle, so what can happen? The Gentiles can be saved. Notice the point. Fix the tabernacle so Gentiles can be saved. Anybody can understand that? Now, if the tabernacle of David has not yet been fixed or raised up, and that's the argument that you're going to find with premillennialists, then what must be true?
None of us are saved.
No Gentiles are saved. And unless you are a Jew, you are out of luck. You are a Gentile. And until this happens, you can't get a right relationship with God. That is an absolutely devastating argument to anybody who has that kind of view, and it is right there in the text. Just look for that word, that. Anybody have something else other than that in 17, Acts 15?
Other than that?
Yeah. That, the residue. Anybody have a word other than that? Okay. All right, so that would be another helpful word. But he's making the point there that the two things are connected. So you may want to underline that or make a marginal note, because sure enough, if you get in discussion, that is very, very helpful information. All right, anything that you want to add or ask about that before I take our last 13 minutes? Tim?
Just that if those people were right about saying that, then that would make God a respecter of persons. Scriptures tell us in more than one place he's absolutely not and isn't going to be. And so, you know, I don't understand how they can draw that conclusion.
Well, there are several things that you could point out there as far as problems with that view. And you could make that argument as well. Now, they might try to say, it's always been true that God has had his special people, and he's going to resume his special people in the future, they're just not quite now. But then you're still back to the problem. If you are not a Jew, you're a Gentile, what's your status before God? Are you saved or lost? Well, I'm saved, they say. Well, how can that be? So a lot of different ways to go at this, but equality certainly is one of the important things that we always want to keep before us. Don?
Well, anything that was said, God could always change that. I mean, he could do whatever he wants to do.
But now remember, he can't do whatever he wants. He can't lie, Titus 1:2. So we want to be careful about making that blanket statement.
But that's what the argument he gave me, that God can take those 144,000 from each tribe and bring them into heaven.
Okay. All right. Well, my question then would be, do you believe that God can lie? Yes or no?
I didn't ask you that.
Well, I think that would be a good question. And if he says, no, God can't lie. Well, okay. Can he ever lie? No, he can never lie. All right. Then he said this. Now he's doing something else. He didn't tell the truth. He lied.
He's taking this literally from Revelation. Not
figuratively. Well, like I said, Revelation is going to be a different class. But at some point, he should be interested in looking at Acts chapter 15. That should be one of the key texts. And I think ask him about that passage and try to keep focused on that and say, we'll be glad to talk about Revelation. But do you believe that the tabernacle of David has or has not been rebuilt? Yes or no? And if he says no, all you have to do is point out, then you can't be saved if you're a Gentile. Because that tabernacle has to be rebuilt for any Gentile to be saved. And then we'll be glad to talk about the 144,000. I'll leave you a copy of my notes after class, if you like, so you can go ahead and take those too.
You're not saying that this counts 144,000?
Well, when you look at Revelation, 144,000, there's a lot of figurative information in the book. I understand the 144,000 as simply a way of describing all the saved. A complete number.
Because again, he took that literally.
I know. Okay, let's go back here and see. We're not going to probably get through all this. But when you go back and you look at David, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back to the Old Testament. And maybe for this, let's go back to, I think, 2 Samuel chapter 6 and actually read the chapter. It's going to be a good bit of material, but at least this will set the stage for us. Yeah, I think that's what I want. Second Samuel starting with 6:1. And David again entered together all the chosen, gathered together all the chosen men of Israel, 30,000. And David arose and went with all the people that were with him to Baal with Judah to bring up from thence what? The Ark of God. Notice the connection between David and the Ark, which is called by the name, even that name of Jehovah of hosts, that sitteth above the cherubim. And they set the Ark of God upon a new cart and brought it out of the house of Abinadab that was in the hill. And Uzziah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, drove the new cart. And they brought it out of the house of Abinadab, which was in the hill, with the Ark of God and Ahio. Sorry, contacts are a little off. Went before the Ark. And David and all the house of Israel played before Jehovah with all manner of instruments made of fir wood, and with harps, and with psalteries, and with timbrels, and with castants, and with cymbals. And they came to the threshing floor of Nazon. Uzziah put forth the hand of the Ark of God and took hold of it, for the oxen stumbled, and the anger of Jehovah was kindled against Uzzah, and God smote him there for his error, and there he died before the Ark. Now, a lot of times you think when people come back to 2 Samuel chapter 6, this is about where they stop. And there's some really helpful information here as far as being obedient to God. And that's all good, but there's more to the story. Verse 8, David was displeased because Jehovah had broken forth upon Uzzah and called this place Perez Uzzah unto this day. And David was afraid of Jehovah that day, and he said, how shall the Ark of Jehovah come unto me? So David would not remove the Ark of Jehovah unto him, unto the city of David, but David carried it aside into the house of Obinadab the Gittite. And the Ark of Jehovah remained in the house of Obinadab the Gittite 3 months, and Jehovah blessed Obinadab and all his house. And again, that's probably about where people stop, but the rest of the chapter, I think, is helpful in understanding Acts chapter 15 and Amos 9. And it was told King David, saying, Jehovah hath blessed the house of Obinadab and all that pertaineth unto him because of the Ark of God. And David went and brought up the Ark of God from the house of Obinadab unto the house, or unto the city of David, with joy. That's where I'd start underlining some things, at least mentally. Joy. And it was so that when they that bear the Ark of Jehovah had gone 6 paces, he sacrificed an ox and a fatling. And David danced, there's another key word, before Jehovah and with all his might. And David was girded with a linen ephod. David and all the house of Israel brought up the Ark of Jehovah with shouting and with sound of triumph. And it was so that the Ark of Jehovah came to the city of David, that Michal, the daughter of Saul, looked out the window and saw King David leaping and dancing before Jehovah. She despised him in her heart for that. And they brought the Ark of Jehovah, and they set it in its place in the midst of what? The tent. Or the tabernacle. There's that same idea again of David, that he'd pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before Jehovah. And when David had made an end of offering the burnt offerings and the peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of Jehovah of hosts. And he dealt among all the people, even among the whole multitude of Israel, both of the men and the women, to everyone to take a cake of bread, a portion of flesh, and a cake of raisins. So all the people departed, everyone to his house. Here's the picture, and there's some information over in Chronicles as well. David has an association with the Ark. And when he has that association with the Ark, what's his attitude towards it? He's reverent, and he's enthused. There is this dancing. There is this joy. And the connection that I want to make, but we're not going to get quite that far today, is that when you start looking at what's promised, let's just run a few passages here. Let's at least get this much of it. Ephesians 2, 20-22, I want that read. We'll take that for us. You have a minute to get there. Ephesians 2, 20-22. Lois. After that, I want somebody else to head over to the book of 1 Peter, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. We're going to split that verse. And then we'll go back, I think, to Acts chapter 15 and verse 17, and then we'll pick up Revelation chapter 21, verses 1 through 4. Revelation 21, 1 to 4 will be our last one for today's class. Revelation reader? All right, that'll be Betty. Okay, let's go over to Ephesians chapter 2, 20 to 22.
been built upon the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, Christ Jesus himself being the cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being fitted together, is growing into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together into a dwelling of God in the Spirit.
Okay, so here you have the ark. Obviously, it ends up in Solomon's temple eventually, but for a while, David's got it. There's this structure that he builds for it. I want to propose that what's taking place with the tabernacle and the temple ultimately points forward to the church. God has this big structure planned. Has had this big structure planned from eternity. Ephesians 2, 20 through 22. The thing that prefigured that, the thing that was pointing forward to that was the ark. All right, 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5. Let's start with the first part of the verse. 1 Peter 2, 5. There it is. All right, God's got this house. Remember Ephesians 2, 20 to 22? If you're going to build a house, what do you need? You need material. All right, Peter picks up on the point and says, look, there is material. What is it? Living stones. God's got rocks, but they're people. All right, the rest of the verse, please, Maxine.
You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ.
Thank you. Peter doesn't lay everything out, but he builds on that house idea. He says, you're the rocks, and he says, what are you going to do with rocks? You're living stones to offer up spiritual sacrifices through Christ. So that's what's taking place in this spiritual house prefigured by the tabernacle. As you go back to Acts chapter 15 and verse 17, let's see what we've got in that 17th verse. That the residue of men, the rest of people, may seek after the Lord. And how many of the Gentiles? All the Gentiles. Now Amos, back in Amos chapter 9, says the people of Edom. Were the people of Edom friends or not friends with Israel? They were not friends. They were Israel's enemies. But Amos said that even the Edomites are going to be involved with this. And then let's pick up that passage that we cited, Revelation chapter 21, verses 1 through 4.
I saw a new heaven and a new earth. The first heaven and the first earth have passed away, and the sea is no more. I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven.
Let's stop there for just a second. He sees the New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven. Well, does that sound like the earth is still in existence or not? It does. And I believe that that's a reference to the church. Would you keep reading, please, Betty?
Made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. I heard a loud voice out of heaven saying, behold, God's tent is with
you. Ah, wait, there it is. Something comes down from heaven. And what that is, it is God's tent. It is God's tabernacle. That Old Testament tabernacle that David had. And he was so concerned about the ark. It was pointing forward to what we have in the church. You can finish it out through verse 4 if you would, Betty.
Verse 4.